RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
The main title sequence for David Fincher's 1995 Oscar-nominated feature film Seven was a major step change in title design. Its edgy, scratchy, and frenetic quality spawned many imitations. Its creator, Carl Cooper, is my guest today. He has been hailed as the natural heir to the great Saul Bass, and also dubbed as the reinventor of film title design as an art form. But Cooper himself takes this in his stride. His passion and dedication for his craft is very evident in this fascinating and revealing interview, which was recorded while he was in the UK for a lecture. Due to technical problems, the last segment of the interview was completed over a transatlantic line from Carl Cooper's studio base in Venice, California. So my apologies in advance for the change in sound quality.
Well, Carl, I'd like to kick off with the fact, and I'm sure you're very bored with this fact, it's been 13 years since the opening titles of Seven invaded our cinema screens, and I just wanted to know from you, because I'm sure you've spoken about that particular sequence so much, that I thought I'd get it out of the way at the beginning. But did you know when you were working on that project the kind of how special it was going to be? Did you have
no,
an inkling at all?
I didn't have an inkling. I just knew I wanted it to be good, and I had the good fortune of only working on one thing at that time. I was working at R. Greenberg in Los Angeles, in the Los Angeles office, and there was talk about Bob Greenberg closing that office and, you know, possibly moving to San Francisco, possibly doing more interactive work. But the point is, I was the creative director and I had a number of things going on, mm-hmm. and I just kind of made a conscious decision that I was only going to work on one thing and not try to, you know, and do the best that I could do without being sort of encumbered by any, you know, there was no one telling me that I had to be concerned about the budget or the amount of people working on it or all these sort of traditional constraints that we had had, partly because, you know, Bob had disengaged a little bit from the LA mm-hmm. office. I think he, you know, we ended up buying out RGALA and naming it, you know, starting Imaginary Forces. But I just kind of locked myself in this small room, ironically under the stairs next to, you know, we had some spillover space, and I just decided to do the best that I could and focus on that one thing. And I really wanted to impress David Fincher. I really liked his, you know, Fincher was coming off a not a very successful first directorial outing, at least critically. He had directed, I think, Aliens, or I'm sorry, maybe the third installment of the Alien movie, and it didn't get, that was his first movie, if I'm correct, and it didn't get, didn't do too well at the box office. And, you know, he really wanted to do well on this, you know, I think this was going to be a good movie, and I wanted to do a good job for him. But I remember every time I edit something or I work on an edit with an editor, I never have the editor pick selects. I always pick the pieces that I want to use, you know, so I throw everything away that I'm not interested in because I don't want to have any shots that I don't think are the best looking shots.
Yeah,
and it's not necessarily story driven.
Yeah,
you would think that it's all about the story, but it's, I don't want anything ugly in there. And so I picked every single shot that I knew I wanted to use. And I sort of gave those to the editor. But even at that time, I remember thinking, do we really have anything here? You know, do I have enough dailies? You know, do we have enough time to shoot enough pieces? I liked, there's a sort of shot looking through the book pages where the hand is backlit.
Yeah.
So sort of straight down the line of the spine. And I thought that that would be a sort of good thread, you know, to go back to that a couple of times in the edit. But again, I wondered if I had got it on the day after shooting for 2 days. I wondered if I had, which I think is the specific answer to your question is I wasn't sure I got it. I wasn't sure I got it.
You clearly did get it. And I mean,
get the pieces, you know?
I mean, and then the fact is, after that, all of these kind of accolades were thrown at you. You know, that not since Saul Bass's opening title sequence generated so much excitement, and that you were the natural heir to single-handedly revitalize titles as an art form, and so on and so on and so on. And it got, you know, everyone absolutely loved it around the world. So how did you feel then, suddenly, all this is being reflected back at you? How did you feel?
I think I was kind of naive then, to be honest. I was younger, 13 years younger, and I was very obsessive, possibly to a fault. And I think that obsessiveness at that time in my life played out to an inability to say no to anything, you know, sort of growing up. If somebody asked me to do something, I would always try to do it. And maybe it's an insecurity or an obsessiveness, or I don't know what character, you know, personality defect that is born out of, you know, what. But all these people started asking us to do things and asking me to work on things, and, you know, and I should have taken the same attitude that I had with the Seven title, which was to just work on one thing at a time. And in fact, I remember somebody telling me, you know, you need to be really careful because a lot of people are going to ask you to do things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can't do it all. And so I started building this company and hiring other designers, and the company's growing, and trying to get all these things done. And I think that you can only do one good thing at a time. You can only focus on one thing at a time.
So do you think that success came a little too early for you in terms of...
I think that I didn't, you know, I wasn't probably secure enough in my own ability that I felt like I needed to keep, you know, keep working on things that probably I shouldn't have worked on. In retrospect, I wouldn't work on now.
Okay, well, before we go on to talk about what the main body of work, I want to shuttle back to your early days. You were born in Swampscott, Massachusetts.
That's right.
What sort of life did you have there as a young child?
I would draw all the time. I think that you know, my mother and my grandfather, my parents were divorced when I was 8. And my mother was very supportive of my art. And, you know, I wasn't really good in sports. And the way that I would deal with things, you know, would be to just draw. You know, I had that one thing that I could do well, that I could do better than anybody else. And so you sort of take refuge in that thing. And you know, well, I might not be a great football player, but I can draw. And I always won art awards in every grade growing up. You know, but we had problems. It was sort of difficult childhood, I think.
Did you have brothers or sisters?
I had two brothers. I had an older brother. I was in the middle. And an older brother and a younger brother.
Yeah.
And we got in a lot of trouble, you know, and fought with each other and got in, you know, it's the North Shore of Boston, kind of a working class town. Okay. A lot of Irish and Italian families. And it wasn't very culturally advanced. You know, there wasn't a lot of... You could go into Boston, but we didn't go into Boston very much. And there wasn't a lot of... Outside of my family, you know, people would pick on you if you're an artist. You know, you get a lot of... You pick fights. People pick fights with you because you're an artist. And not a lot of support from guidance counselors and other... You know, kids, and so I'd get in fights, you know, and so it was a little hard. That and that's the other thing, you know, always wanting to prove something, you know, trying to, this idea of, there's like two ways of working, you know, one way is to sort of prove yourself and run everyone else off their feet, and the other way is just, you know, exercising your gift instead of saying, you know, it's like the Harry Abraham, Eric Little thing from Chariots of Fire. It's like, I'm going to run these people off their feet, and I'm going to, you know, prove everyone wrong that didn't think I was would amount to anything. And then it's kind of like, well, no, I run because God made me fast. It's like the times where I would just create things and draw things because I felt like I had a gift.
Yeah.
Rather than to prove that I was worth something, you know. But what was it like? So, you know, my mother was very supportive, but it was difficult growing up in that town, I think. And it was a, you know, it wasn't a lot of encouragement. Certainly not any encouragement for filmmaking, you know, not a lot of.
So were your
not
main,
a lot of directors coming sure, out of Swampscott,
Massachusetts. Sure. So your main distractions, sort of going in on yourself creatively, drawing a lot and creating your own kind of worlds.
Yeah, obsessive worlds that I could control.
Yeah.
You know, I could control my own, what was on the page. And even in graphic design, you know, when I started doing that, just laying out the newspaper at college, I could have control over this little world.
Okay, so tell me...
If I couldn't have any control over the external world, I could control this
sure,
world.
So tell me when that started to kick in, i.e. that there was a possibility of a creative world that you could enter into. Because I know from previous conversations with people who come from a similar kind of background, a working class background, there is, simply because of the nature of life, often parents, you know, it's too beyond their understanding that there is such a thing as graphic design or a creative world. That's for people with a lot of money or that go to colleges. And so your natural inclination is to be looking to the factories and the local industry, which is depressing as hell. And
yeah, my parents weren't like that. You know, my they were fascinated, I think, you know, that I had that talent. I think they were proud that I could draw, and so they would never discourage me. The discouragement came primarily from the schools,
yeah,
you know, schools and guidance counselors and peers, you know,
yeah,
other kids
who would be jealous of the fact you could draw
something,
so they
would
beat
yeah,
you up instead.
Yeah, well, that, you know, but I wasn't. They didn't beat me up because we were all my older brother. We all. You know, that was the one, I thought that you could, you know, the suggestion is you're kind of introverted and
yeah,
effeminate that
yeah,
you
yeah,
can draw, but
sure,
we went to great lengths to prove that you didn't have to be you didn't have to be like that to be, that's why I you know, you can be an artist and be cool too.
Absolutely.
in that context. And I, in fact, in my fraternity in college, one of my best friends, my roommate, was an artist. He prided himself on being good fighter, but there'd be a lot of fight in UMass. There was a lot of people fighting and drinking and all that was going on. You know, I'd come back and I had my drafting table. I'd have been working on a rendering for a week, and there would people smash pumpkins and beer bottles on the thing. But my mother always encouraged me to draw. And in fact, my grandfather, I think I was only 7 years old, my grandfather was a carpenter. And he was in the Salvation Army. He's a very, you know, decent man, and a very, he always, you know, was doing things for other people. He'd like rebuild these old ladies' porches and things when, you know, just for free, that they need to always be helping people. And he wanted to be, when he was older, he started writing all this poetry that he wanted to write during his life. But he said to me, I must have been only 7 years old, he said, you know, my son, if you don't do something with your artistic talent, you'll regret it for the rest of your life. And it's so strange coming from, I'll never forget that, because coming from him, you know, he was not the kind of person that you would think would be in tune to that or would be, you know, encouraging of that. And, you know, I took his advice. I always tried to get some kind, you know, but it was all about work. It's all about getting a job. Can you get a job? You know, can you... How are you going to get a job being an artist, or how are you going to get a job being a filmmaker in that kind of Boston? How are you going to get work doing that? You
yeah,
know, and you need to be an engineer or something, and you listen to that nonsense. And meanwhile, at the time that they're telling me there's no work to be had creatively in film, you know, they're doing the Creature Shop at Industrial Light and Magic is doing Star Wars and E.T. and Raiders of the Lost Ark.
So you
that.
Were pretty fixated early on about wanting to get into film. I mean,
yeah, I wanted to
necessarily just pure graphic design, but you wanted to get into film.
No, graphic film. Design. It was film. Film was what I was most interested in. I would love to watch horror movies. movies of any kind, but you know, fantasy movies and you know, Blade Runner and
sure.
I wanted to do that and The Dead Zone and you know, Altered States, but it was in college. Well, let me think about that. You know, I made a series of posters and things before I went to college, but they were, you know, illustrative posts, nothing about typography, illustrations, you know, from my mother's friends and things, you know, hand-drawn type, very remedial things. But I also used to go into the dictionary and pick words and try to, you know, make a drawing that had the type doing what it said.
Yeah.
Which was something that,
yeah,
you know, somebody noticed that and encouraged me to do more of that in graphic design. But the point is, graphic design in college from my freshman year at the University of Massachusetts was a way of paying the bills. I had work study. I worked for the newspaper, pasting up the newspaper with waxers.
Yeah.
I worked making logos for small businesses. So,
so this I wanted would have to be been a filmmaker. What sort of age would you have been at that point?
When I started at 18.
18, yeah.
Yeah, 18.
Yeah.
And the summer going into college, a friend of mine's father knew the governor of Massachusetts, one of my friends, and he knew somebody, and he got me a job as a toll collector at the Massachusetts Turnpike Authority at the Callahan Tunnel in Boston. And that summer, you know, it was a high-paying municipal job, and I was very lucky to have it. A lot of people wanted that. You have to, you know, it's so kind of, it's not, it's corrupt in a way. You had to know somebody who knew somebody to get this kind of job. It's a municipal job. But I remember collecting tolls and saying to myself, this is the last job that I'm ever going to do that isn't art related, that isn't design related. I'm going to, no matter what it is, no matter how much they pay me, I'm never going to do anything else. Because I was a dishwasher. I did all, I mean, I worked since I was, you know, had a paper route when I was really young, and then when I was 14, I lied about my age so I could be a porter at Dunkin' Donuts. I was, you know, mopping the floor at Dunkin' Donuts, and I don't know if you're there.
Which has a great logo.
Yeah, it's a beauty, isn't it? That's I saw the Dunkin' Donuts logo. That's what made me want to go into this business. Do they have Dunkin' Donuts here?
They don't, but they did for a brief time way back in the 60s, actually. And I remember seeing the logo and thinking how lovely it was.
Yeah.
Because you were just saying, type that, you know, does what
it is. Is that the one that has the donut code in the coffee cup there?
No, it has the very rounded
Dunkin'
donut. It looks like donuts, yeah. Basically, you know.
Wordplay. But then I started doing type, but type, you know, doing graphic design was the vocational thing.
Yeah.
You'll never get a job as a filmmaker. Okay, well, let me try to be a, because I try to be a graphic designer, but they didn't have a graphic design program at UMass. They had two classes. It was commercial art, and it was very illustrative.
And you did interior design.
Well, I got a scholarship. I'm not going to lie to you. I mean, at that time in my life, I was getting in a lot of trouble, and school, I wasn't a good student in high school at all, you know, and the English teachers was my mother's friend. She used to give me a better grade if I would make a drawing on the cover of my papers. I didn't do well in math, but my mother knew the chief administrator at the University of Massachusetts, and both my parents had gone to the University of Massachusetts, so that was the only place that I could go to get in to college. It was UMass, because my mother knew this woman, but because of my grades, I think, you know, unless I tried to go to an art school, but there was a lot of discouragement going to art school, and I wanted to go to a school where my friends were going at that time. I was kind of, you know, didn't know any better, I don't think. But the point is, to get the money to go to school, I applied for a scholarship. There was a woman who picked two kids every year. It was the Wilhelmina Dennings Jackson Memorial Scholarship, and it went to the outstanding student in fine art. And I won the scholarship myself, and you know, one person from my town and one person from the next town over. But the stipulation was, with this scholarship I won, I had to study something. I had to major in art. I was a sculpture major, I was a fine arts major, or foundations program, and everybody kept saying, you're never going to get a job you know, as a sculptor or as a filmmaker, you need to get a job. Okay, what can I major in and still be in the fine arts program? Interior design. All right, I'll try to be an interior designer. I didn't care for interior design. I appreciate it much more now. I'm much more in tune to it right now, but I liked graphic design better because it seemed more immediate to me. It seemed like I could make a poster and I could have a joke on my poster and you could get my joke and I could have this kind of, my brother could understand what the poster I was making, and there was an immediacy and a desire to communicate on a more specific level. You know what I mean? I understand that you can get and have an emotional response to a space, but I wanted, you know, more of a one-liner kind of a response to something that I made. So I started working as a graphic designer because that was all that I could do. When did I start to get serious about it? I touched on this last night. I was walking across the campus one day, living in a fraternity and not doing well in interior design, and somebody, I think actually my mother's friend, came up to me and told me that my mother had been in this accident, and it was as if, you know, it's like in Henry V, where there's this moment, you know, where, you know, the offending atom was whipped out of him, and he immediately changed. He immediately left the bar room and, you know, talks about the sweetest berries growing among baser fruit. And I, you know, I relate to that because immediately I was just like, oh my gosh, I was basically raised by my mother and she's dying. And my response was, you know, possibly denial or something, but I was more like, I better get busy. You know, I better figure out what I'm going to do now, because all of a sudden I'm alone in the world. And the other thing is, you realize everything I was doing, every time I would draw something as a kid, all of a sudden it became clear to me that I was drawing it for validation from my mother, to say, I wanted someone to say, oh, that's great, honey. And all of a sudden I'm like, what am I, there's no one who's looking at my drawings now. You know, I don't have that validation. But I walked into the internship office. There was a paper that had just come in that day. It's a complete fluke that even came in, because one guy, a friend of mine, did a postgraduate internship at Wang Laboratories Corporate Communications Department. He got to do the internship because he was working as a security guard there. They never would have taken an intern from UMass. They wouldn't even look at UMass for an intern. Mm-hmm. Everyone there had a master's degree from Yale or the Rhode Island School of Design. Some of them had two. One guy had a master's degree in both architecture and graphic design. But they fill out a form at the end of the postgraduate internship and they send it to the internship office. And this guy, as a formality, had to send in the form. He convinced them somehow to let him do this internship in a postgraduate way. And I walked in that day, you know, the day that I got that news about my mother, I walked into the internship office and I took this piece of paper and they said, well, you can't take that out of the office. And I said, let me just have it for 24 hours. And I contacted the guy and, you know, as I said last night, you know, maybe they felt bad for me or whatever, because I remember Hugh Dubberly, you know, who went to Rhode Island School of Design and then got a master's degree from Yale. I remember him saying when he looked at my work, like, why would you use a typeface like that? You know, it was very illustrative and silly gouache paintings of dragons and, you know, but he looked at some of the wordplay things and he said, do you like doing that? And I said, yeah, you know, I do. And so they let me be this intern. It was a non-paid internship, but everybody there kept saying, you know, wait till you meet Paul Rand, and talking about typography, and all of a sudden that, you know, I'm very appreciative of that. That opened my eyes about typography. And it also, they had show and tell, and one week someone brought in a reel of main titles and it had Altered States and it had some of the Greenberg work, it had a few Saul Bass titles, and I was like, oh wow. You know, and I actually got my hands on a brochure from R. Greenberg. I remember this black, slick, maybe poorly printed because the fold, it wasn't, the score was cracking, it was like the varnish was cracking, I remember, but it was like this slick sort of spot varnish promotional piece for our Greenberg Associates. And I said, I want to work, you know, I saw that main titles was this way of transcending the argument, you know, that I could, if I could do that, I could be a filmmaker and a graphic designer.
Yeah.
But they still encouraged me to go to Yale, and they still walked me through a lot of these typographic experiments at Wang, and they helped me put a portfolio together. And I know for a fact that Alvin Eisenman is the head of the program, or was the head of the program at Yale for many years. And one year he took a sabbatical, and Philip Burton, who went to Basel, picked the class. They pick 18 kids to get in. And Philip had only picked a class one other time. And the people that were in the class that Philip had picked the first time were all of my teachers who Hugh Doubley hired at Wang. So Peter Levine, Phyllis Aragaki, Rick Mell, Randy Swearer, Hugh Doubley were all in the same class at Yale, and they were all, he hired them all to start this corporate communications department at Wang Laboratories Computer Company. And so all those guys were from the other class that Philip had picked, and they were at a wedding, and they pulled Philip aside at the wedding and said, you know, you have to, you got to look at Kyle, you know, you have to, which is, you know, such a blessing to me that they would do that. So I got into Yale, and that was a coup for me, and I liked it so much there, you know, because they kept telling me about Paul Rand.
Yeah.
And Paul Rand only taught a master's class. He only taught the second year student. But myself and this other guy from Boston, Bob Burns, we showed up there because Lou Danziger always told Bob about Paul Rand. And we got there in as first year students, and when Paul Rand had his master class, we just went. You know, we said we want to, and they all said, you can't be here, you need to go. And the other teacher said, well, this is Mr. Rand, is, you know, you don't get to have Mr. Rand until the second year. And we were like, you know, these two kids from Boston. It's like, no, we're not going to do it. And then he said, so he came in, and they said, you know, those guys are in the first year, and let them stay, you know. So he everybody talked about how he was, you know, he made the girls cry, and he's, you know, so hard, and such a harsh critic, and, you know, he's like a guy from Brooklyn, and we're these guys from Boston, and that's just the way we talk to each other. We completely, you know, would sit at his feet because we didn't care. You know, we'd say, you tell me if it stinks, right? That's what he'd say. Yeah, yeah. If you're looking for a pat on the back, you came to the wrong place. But we didn't care, you know. Just like that was the thing. It's, you know, he wouldn't hurt my feelings because I didn't profess to know anything anyway. I mean, I was just trying, the same way that I want to please my mother, I want to please David Fincher. I just wanted to make one thing that Paul Rand would like, because he didn't like anything that anybody made. So I shouldn't say that. Once in a while, there'd be like an Asian woman that would make something that he would think was good, but.
So he became your inspiration, mentor.
Well, but Philip was, Philip Burton was, the other teachers were from Basel, but they had good, they had Armin Hoffman came, and Wolfgang Weingart came, and Shigeo Fukuda came, and Germano Fischetti came, and Richard Saul Wurman came, and Bradbury Thompson came, and Paul Rand again. But I wanted to do a tutorial with Paul Rand. And Chris Pullman would come, and the only people that would talk to me about ideas, you know, I wasn't so much about, I still wanted to make a poster that you would get, would make you laugh.
Yeah.
And my, so I was pretty impatient with the formal exercises, the kind of ruling pen things,
yeah.
Drawing letter, Matthew yeah. Carter came, and, yeah. you know, drawing letter forms. Inga Druckery came, and I didn't. I look at Inga Druckery's work now, and it's just like, you know, it's beautiful. But at that time, I'm a kid. I'm 25. I was the youngest kid in the graduate class, and I didn't really care to be thinking about form. I wanted to talk about, you know, main titles or motion or sequence and story and sound and concepts and visual puns, and Mr. Rand was the only one that would, you know, talk about that, but he simultaneously would say an idea is only as good as its execution, and you need to, you know, this looks like it's a good idea, but it stinks, you know, you have to learn how to. So, and, you know, 22 years later, of course, you know, things have to look good, but that took me a while to sink in. You know?
Well, one of the things you said last night, typography is very important to you. Typography, because in so many titles, those sort of considerations often are just not considered at all. But if you have a beautiful piece of typography, and then you have all the other things that you can do with it, with motion graphics, it can make it that much better. And I cite one example of your work, which I think has a supreme elegance, and that's the Donnie Brasco title sequence, which just has this very elegant moving type, which sort of gently fades and moves.
Yeah.
And one can see that, you know, that you have a sensitivity to type. And I also related a bit back to the rhythmic quality that Rand often had in his work. You know, he would be asymmetric in his, you know, he'd be unlike, you know, the Swiss school, where everything was range left and, you know, there was no centering. He seemed to be fairly eccentric in his view of typography.
No, that's completely the point. Like, it, you know, I'm saying I want to talk about motion, and he's saying, you know, there's a moment, man. That's a moment. You know, there's a moment in time. You have to make a moment before you can, you know, if you make one moment, you see how the rest of it will play out.
I think as you pointed out last night, showing some of Paul Rand's work, a lot of it may well be two-dimensional and static, but it's actually moving.
It is moving.
You see, it's almost like a freeze frame.
And that's every composition, you're trying to do that. And that's what I, you know, I didn't, when that guy asked the question about the Cult of the Scratchy thing that Jessica wrote.
Oh, yes.
I didn't care that she was saying that it was a sort of transient, you know, thing, and then it was fleeting. And
I think we should just say for listeners don't understand that the typography in the titles for Seven are scratch almost, they look as if they're scratched onto the emulsion. They're very, very sort of frenetic and strange. And this created post that title sequence being so successful, a lot of people aping that style and wanting to use it because they were so affected by it, and it became scratchy. And I think it was that term was used in an article that you just referred to, and you got kind of lumbered with that. You were Mr. Scratchy.
Right. It certainly happened, but I think it's inappropriate to measure that sequence against that criticism, because, you know, the killer was developing photos in his bathtub, and he was carving. He had a hand, you know, he had his books, and he had these hand-scrawled books, and I was just thinking it was if he was doing a traditional film optical and developing the film and stapling the film together and taping the film with his little rusty splicer in his own bathtub as well. And so I think that typography was completely born out of the idea. The problem then becomes when somebody says, you know, we want something like Seven, and it's for a, you know, car commercial.
Yeah, I mean, how did you resist that, or didn't you resist that? I think you mentioned.
I probably did a bit of it. I probably did a bit of shooting type on film and overexposing type, and you know, the flickery jumping. I mean, it's not so much about making it intentionally flickering. The reality was, I was creating animation editorially, you know, for Mimic and for Donnie Brasco, for that matter. You talk about the type moving, but there is no animation. There's no animation in Mimic, and there's no animation in Seven in terms of After Effects animation or Maya animation.
Yeah.
Or there's no software.
No.
It's animated because I'm just the way that you're editing, and I'm doing cross dissolves, and Donnie Brasco's all cross dissolves, and even Dawn of the Dead recently, I don't animate. I shoot type practically, and then I create the movement by cutting it or just editorial. It's like cell animation.
In fact,
it is
a very traditional form, rather than being too heavily engaged in software.
It's more cell animation.
It's actually more.
And so the thing about the, you know, so I did like shooting type on film. I did do for commercial things that people ask, but this is what I was touching upon at the beginning. I had business partners. All of a sudden, these offers are coming in, and people are paying you, and they're giving you a lot of money, and you know, do this type, and
the ability to say no was
difficult. I think I don't know why I had a hard time saying no.
This was at Imaginary Forces.
We've kind of
skipped your exit from Yale and your entree into into your first creative jobs. Did you go, just to touch on that, did you go straight from Yale into Greenberg's?
I started a little company with two... Here's what happened. So at Yale, because I as I mentioned, going to Yale was a coup for me.
Yeah.
It's a two-year program. I asked Alvin Eisenman, who, just as an aside, said to me, well, I guess I'm digressing, but I don't want to forget to tell the story about Alvin. Alvin said, you know, I told Alvin I was interested in film, and he said, well, you know, Kyle, the world needs more graphic designers than filmmakers. And although that, I took that as discouragement at the time, you know, I actually think, knowing what I know about him and knowing how kind of sage and wise he was, I think he was saying precisely what we were talking about, which was, you know, you need to learn how to see first. You need to be a graphic designer, and then you can be a filmmaker. It's like, the world needs more graphic designers than filmmakers. No, the world needs more graphic designers that are filmmakers. And if you learn how to see and think like a graphic designer, it'll only inform your filmmaking, which is the same thing that Paul Rand said. He said, I don't want to talk about Saul Bass. I don't want to talk about what's happening in Main Titles. I don't want you to do your thesis on Main Titles. I want you to read Film Form and Film Sense by Eisenstein.
Yeah.
And then we'll talk about, you know, we'll talk about form, and we'll talk about film one frame at a time. So to have teachers like that, and to be in that place, you know, this beautiful college. I mean, you can tell by the way I talk about it, it was one of the best times in my life.
Yes.
So I asked Alvin if I could stay a third year. So I had a very good friend, Garson Yu, who was in my class. I would have graduated with him the second year. And then I had another friend, John DeRay, that was in. I graduated with the third year. And we tried to have this little company in New York doing graphic design for about, you know, 2 months. And I got along really well with John, I got along really well with Garson, but the three of us, you know, I get along with anybody. I mean, in terms of working together, I love to collaborate with other people. I have no problem trying to put forward other designers and get other people. Because some of these Main Title sequences are so complex that I kind of have to rally people around them and get everybody to sort of go in the same direction. But those guys didn't get along too well. So I said, you know what, I wanted to work two places. I wanted to work at R. Greenberg Associates, because I wasn't ready to go to California yet. I had seen the titles for Altered States, The Dead Zone, Alien, you know, Untouchables, Blue Steel. I knew all of the body of work that Greenberg did, World According to Garp, Superman. Mm. I wanted to go there, but I also knew Phil Gipps, and Phil Gipps went to Yale. And I didn't know him, I knew of him, and I knew that he had a company called Frankfurt Gipps Ballkind.
The great Stephen Frankfurt.
Stephen,
I knew
Stephen Frankfurt.
Go ahead. Well, I mean, I think I'd just slot this in here because I know that it's a great influence on you, and certainly, personally for me, I think one of the best all-time title sequences is
To Kill a Mockingbird,
simply because it's a... It was the first, although Bass had done sort of narrative pieces, this was the most complete narrative story told as a title sequence, which is in black and white, it's sort of tabletop, very close in macro quality, with a great sensitivity, child's voice singing and humming in the background, crayon scribing across the screen, and then with the most perfect piece of music. It's so emotional, and that it sets the scene for that film perfectly, which it couldn't be a more perfect introduction to what is also an incredibly moving and sensitive film. It seemed to me the first time that a title really was integral to the film, as opposed to slotted on the front.
Yep. And here's the thing. Yeah. But that people make more out of that being an influence. For me, it's a bit more of a post-rationalization than an influence, because I wasn't so familiar with that title as I was familiar with the marketing for Alien, which Steve Frankfurt brought to Greenberg, and you know, the kind of when advertising tried harder mentality that Stephen Frankfurt as a creative director at the agencies, I want to say Young and Rubicam, kind of brought to his poster design. So I wanted to work at Frankfurt Gibson Balkind for Stephen Frankfurt and Phil Gibbs because I had seen the posters that they did for Rosemary's Baby and Downhill Racer and more recently the Jagged Edge. But I didn't like the Jagged Edge poster as much as Rosemary's Baby and Emmanuel, the X is Never Like This typography one. I was more familiar with that print work, and I didn't even realize that Stephen Frankfurt did To Kill a Mockingbird. But the point is, I just identified those two places that I wanted to work and those people that I wanted to work for, and I got a job at Frankfurt Gibson Balkind, and I worked with Stephen Frankfurt for a little bit, and I worked with Phil Gibbs for a little bit, and then Greenberg called me and said, you know, we want you to come here. You know, I had submitted my application a while ago, and I was really kind of torn, because here is, again, my wanting to please and not wanting to say no. I didn't want to tell Phil Gibbs, after he just hired me out of Yale, that I couldn't work there anymore. But they weren't doing so much motion work at Frankfurt Gibson Balkind. They weren't. It was all print, and so I really wanted to do the titles. Mm. Have a shot at doing the titles, even though Bob Greenberg said to me, you know, you can come and do print design, but I'm not sure if you have an aptitude in motion graphics. Which, in retrospect, I think is kind of not. I'm not saying it from a place of arrogance. Like, you know, how could he say that to me? I'm saying that as a general philosophy, especially in light of what's going on in the world today or has been for the last 15 years, how can a good graphic designer not have an aptitude in motion? I mean, perhaps some Swiss designers that you're... Yeah. But I think to be a graphic designer, you know, I find it impossible to imagine how that can't carry over into an understanding of... music and cadence and, but that's just me. I thought I was going to be good at that, so I said, fine, I'll take the job at Greenberg. I'll do your print work and just let me pitch on whatever titles come in. And, you know, 40 titles later, you know, in the background, you know, helping Richard Greenberg when he came back and helping Bob, I became the creative director there. And then they sent me to LA to start RGALA, and I was one of the first guys to be sent out to LA, and when I got there, Richard and Bob had gotten back together, and I had to take over. You know, Richard needed a lot of help, and he had movie titles like Used People and Groundhog Day and Rising Sun was going on and Quiz Show, and I got all these, Amos and Andrew was another one, I got all these things kind of dumped on me. Matinee, you know, Kyle, you gotta come in. And so I kind of hit the ground running and was trying to help, you know, Indecent Proposal, right? A lot of things. Joy Luck Club. And then when I was creative director at R. Greenberg in New York, I had Garson, I hired some of my friends from Yale. Garson Yu was a guy that I mentioned that I had the company with. Him and John I ultimately hired at R. Greenberg, and I brought Garson to LA, and I started staffing up the RGALA design team, and I hired Karen Fong, who had gone to Yale, and Michael Riley, who went to RISD, and Jacob Trollbeck. I hired at Greenberg in New York, and all these people have gone on. You know, there's probably 15 design companies in Los Angeles that are owned by people that I hired to come and work. And then our GALA, we bought out. I'm sorry, Imaginary. So I started Imaginary Forces.
Yeah.
I took the name from the prologue of Henry V, and we bought out RGALA, and I asked Peter Frankfurt, who's Stephen Frankfurt's son, to go into business, you know, to be my partner in Imaginary Forces, because Peter, he had a lot of relationships. He was doing development for Bob Greenberg, and he was developing some features. He was developing, I think he might have started developing Blade at that time, but he knew a lot of the people in Hollywood, and we thought that Peter kind of had a lot of connections. And so I invited Peter to be my partner in Imaginary Forces, and Chip Houghton was the executive producer. Bob sent Chip out, you know, several months after, maybe a year after I had been there, to come out and run RGALA, and we all just kind of, we didn't know, I didn't know It just seemed like Bob was moving towards interactive, and he's he's very wise that way. Bob's a very good businessman, and he historically has moved towards, he sees what's happening, and modifies or sort of reinvents his business to follow these trends. And
I actually met him when he was over here, also giving a DNAD lecture.
Yeah.
And he made it quite clear that they had moved back away from titles now, titles, because he found them, I think, problematic, whatever, but he felt the future for him and his company was very much in interactive mobile phones, street advertising, all of these new technologies that
and he's always been I remember, I was there when he was, deciding that was going to be the future that he wanted to pursue, and he wanted to become the expert in that area. And it's very wise of him. But I was, when he was talking about that, he asked me about going to San Francisco to do this interactive thing. And it's a sort of shoot the moon mentality, or it's not, perhaps it's not responsible, but it's how I felt. I wanted to do titles, period. Yeah, sure. I wanted to do titles since I saw that thing at Wang. And so he's, and the same thing happened at Imaginary Forces. You asked me about my exit from Imaginary Forces. My business partners are talking about experience design and architecture, and we're doing all this work in architectural, environmental design, and revisioning the World Trade Center after the, how are we going to rebuild that? And all this stuff is happening in Imaginary Forces. And I tried to facilitate that kind of growth by finding, I always found the designers to hire. But when everybody said, when the producers would say, we should be doing this, and we should be in this business, and we should be taking the business in this direction, I would just be like, I'm a title designer.
Yeah, it would seem to me, actually, talking to you, that I've heard this before, and to some extent it happened to me as well. You, as the company grows, you find yourself being distanced from the very thing that you really want to do.
Yeah.
And all we want to do is design, because that's the reason we started. And as a company becomes successful and more complicated components get slotted in, you find you're becoming a producer, or you're becoming a manager, or
that's all that it is. It's only that. And you also find that the one-on-one interaction that I'm having with David Fincher, who's this man that I admire, I'm somehow distanced from that client service, and I'm in the position of building this army of people that can be doing the one-on-one interaction, which is the one-on-one interaction is, I'm sure that, I don't know that Stephen Frankfurt had a relationship with the director of the movie, but I have to assume that there's some kind of creative back and forth, and that, a couple of very creative people trying to, figure out what the solution is to that problem. And I just, it's smarter from a business standpoint for me to build 15 different silos, each head by its own creative director, that how are we going to do 50 projects? We're going to have 50 units. And this team is going to have it. I'm going to, and that's what I did. I hired kids out of school. I sort of poured myself into them until they got to the point where they could do, they did a bunch of things under me, and then they got to the point where they could do their own work, and then they ran their own team, and I start building all these teams, and we're disseminating the work to all the teams, and I don't have that one-on-one meditative relationship with my own work, which is, I have other, and when I did do my own work, people were saying, hey, maybe it would be better for the company if you worked on this, or hey, maybe it'd be better for the company if you did that a little bit faster. And
so you're being pulled in all directions. So,
and I'm praying, this is I'm cutting this, and this is my you're molesting my contemplation. This is my form of worship. I'm listening to my work, and you're telling me to hurry up and don't use the equipment for so long, and we have to actualize these jobs, and this job has a budget, and you only have 2 hours on the flame. So I own this flame, man. It's like, what are you talking about?
So you're in the classic position where actually the job is actually controlling you rather than you controlling the job. So you get frustrated and you leave.
I was I love the people that I hired, the designers that I hired, and I'm proud of them when they make something. Even the people that have started their own companies that compete with me, that I brought into this business, I take some genuine pleasure when I see them make something good. I'm happy for them. That's why I talk about iron sharpening iron. I mean, I try to hire designers and give them opportunities, and this idea of having a community. You know, it ideally we would make each other better. And so I don't have any bad feelings about anything, but I didn't feel like I was growing creatively. I just wanted to do something else. I saw Alan Fletcher at one of these RSA things several years ago, and I said, hey, you know, why'd you leave Pentagram? And he's like, I just want to do something else, man. You know, and there might be all this... There might be all this backstory that I don't know. Maybe you know, but wrong with that reason?
There's nothing wrong with that reason. I think it's something that many people that have had great success, you know, suddenly sit down in the small hours and think, you know what, I'm not happy at just being... taking on projects sometimes that I shouldn't take on because it's been driven by the company, because we've got a big overhead, and you know, maybe okay, we'll take it on because it'll bring in some more cash, and then maybe I'll be able to do something else. And you get to the point where you're not doing that something else, and so finally you have to make the big decision. Many people don't make that decision, and they become really glorified managers, and they lose that's magic, that's something that sparked them in the first place, that internal spirit that actually is always in there trying to get out.
Or you just find a balance, because I'm not taking the stereotypical kind of position that, you know, business and the needs of business and the needs of design are contrary and they can't be reconciled and you can't have a successful company. I think Prologue is a good company.
Tell me how that started. So you finally decided to part company with Imaginary Forces. Was that...
Yeah, but I'm still affiliated.
You are.
I haven't, you know, and I don't... I didn't hire anybody. I didn't take anybody that works there, and I don't usually... I don't consider myself a competitor because, you know, we don't usually pitch on the same kinds of things. Like I say, they're building these other areas of business. I was building the main title business, although I do a lot of different things. But so we do a lot of network broadcast packages, and we do a lot of commercials now at Prologue, and I'm happy to do those things. I think that you can achieve the balance doing good work for business, and I like to have the freedom of making my own decisions about what work to take on.
Yeah.
And I think that I can transcend the argument better now because I'm responsible for my own choices, good or bad.
Sure.
You know, because I'm the only person that, you know, Prologue is my company. I mean, I guess myself and my wife.
Yeah.
You know, and even having my wife participate in the business adds another person into the mix, so I even have some mild altercations with my wife about, you know, no, I want to do this.
Sure.
So, but that's okay because I have to do that because I live with this person and she's the mother of my four children, and so, okay, honey, you don't want me to do that job, then you know I'll take that into consideration. But it's just a little easier to not have so many, to have other people's opinions to reconcile in addition.
Okay, I wanted to touch on one thing which would interest me, and I've not heard much spoken about it, and that is in 2001, you kind of moved across to the director's seat proper, and you directed Newport South, the only feature that you've directed. And interestingly, you know, not wanting to make these connections with Saul Bass, he only directed one film, which was Phase 4, and never directed another. Can you tell me a little bit about the experience of it and what you learned from it and what your feelings are about it?
What I learned from directing that feature is that you give up a year or more of your life, a year and a half to 2 years of your life to do it, you know, possibly less, but in my instance, it was giving up a significant portion of my life. And you have to really believe in the story, and you have to really know the material. And I feel like, again, I was younger. I don't think I'm the same person now that I was. And somebody said, "You want to direct a feature?" And I just rushed in and said, "Of course I want to die. What else? I can do Mission Impossible 2, or I can direct a feature." You know, without necessarily weighing the decision, just kind of going for it. I had a amazing relationship with the DP. Juan Ruiz Anchia was my sort of partner, and he would, I'd get up every morning and draw out everything that we're going to shoot, and I loved being in Chicago in the winter shooting this thing. And I shot 500,000 feet of film, and I kept thinking that in the same way that if someone comes to you with a brief for a design problem, or a main title or a commercial, even if you're not quite sure about the brief, you can make it better if you just get down to it, it'll sort itself out.
Yeah.
And I didn't get a chance to do my obsessive one frame at a time editing for that movie, and I shot all this footage that was never used in the movie, and everyone said, "You need to just..." I would have done things differently.
Mm.
I would have more insisted on my director's cut.
Yeah.
I have a cut in my mind that I would like to do, and I still cut little bits of it now here and there, and I'd like to show my director's cut.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of what I do comes out in the edit, and I didn't feel like I cut something that I like. So what did I learn from that? Number one, I learned that it's okay to be a title designer. In the same way that I said when everyone wanted to move into different areas of business that I wanted to do titles, everyone talks about the logical progression, but I think there's something kind of noble about the fact that Paul Rand was still designing logos until a week before he died, and there's no one saying, you should be a filmmaker, you should take it to the next level, you should do this.
Yeah.
If what I am is a title designer, I don't feel like I haven't.
So
my life is any lesser. I want to be I want to be a good father, and I want to be a title. If I'm a title designer, that's my, because I like that I have so much experience in my one craft and my one trade that I can go into a project and I can take one meeting, and I think better than most other people. I can say, oh, this is the problem. This is what we have to do. And if we don't do it this way, these five things are going to go wrong.
Mm.
I know exactly how to put these things together.
Mm.
And
Do I take it from that you probably will not direct another film? Well, never say never, but it's not on your horizon.
I'm very interested in building Prologue right now. That's my project right now. I have this sort of a sequence of things that I want to accomplish in my mind, and where I am right now is, take care of my kids, make Prologue work. The quote from The Tempest that says what's past is prologue, I think that's kind of appropriate. It's everything I learned from Imaginary Forces is now, I feel like, coming to fruition in this new thing. I keep talking about choices that I made at that time in my life that possibly weren't the best choices, but all of those choices have put me into this direction or this situation right now that I'm very excited about. Mm. I really feel like I'm 46. I guess that's old, but I still feel like, you know, I talk to people that are in their 70s and they're very sharp, and I feel like I'm just beginning to figure myself out and figure out what I want to do.
And with Prologue, you're getting more deeply immersed into whole areas of movies now.
Yeah, and so I think that I have opportunities to work on features, and people come to me with, you know, talking about the idea of doing another movie, and I have content that I'm thinking about developing, but there isn't this sort of sense of urgency that I had when I was younger, that unless I do this thing, unless I can prove that I can make these features, you know, I don't think I'm going to wake up tomorrow and be Ridley Scott, you know.
So one of the things I wanted to also ask is how you see your area of design actually expanding or evolving over the next decade, because there's been quite a leap in the last decade. I wonder how you saw things moving in the near future.
What's been happening is that the graphic designers that had participated in the filmmaking process in the main titles and in the end titles are seeping into the body of the film proper.
Yeah.
We're doing a lot of these premeditated and ideally visually sophisticated sequences within the body of the film itself, and not just, you know, when there's been a graphic designer on a film historically, their role has been to put decals on planes and
sure.
generate newspapers,
yeah.
ephemeral material to be shot. But because graphic designers are now animators and editors and musicians, you know, and that technology is in their hands, ideally the cream will rise to the top and there'll be more graphic designers making headway into the filmmaking process, and perhaps we'll see some innovative ways of thinking about filmmaking.
So that, I mean, that sounds very exciting. It sounds, much more kind of expansive and rewarding for you, because you'll be, have a much bigger hold on things rather than just be involved on the beginning and the end, which, as you said yourself earlier on, coming to terms with that actually you're very comfortable with being a title designer. And I'm very pleased to hear that, because there are so few really good ones around. And one of the things you mentioned earlier on is that you said, I think, that, you know, film is so impoverished sometimes. And by that, I think you probably meant that there is a lack of care in those design aspects of films, which I've always found extraordinary with talented directors who actually overlook the whole process of the beginning and an end of a film. They almost hand it over to someone else to produce, and with the most horrible results.
Yeah, that they do. There is obviously there's many directors that respect the process, that it can have a significant impact, and then there's some that concede that that's not their area of expertise, and they just, like you say, hand it off to somebody who may have been qualified at some. You know, there's a lot of people that need graphic design. Still, sometimes that the idea that seems naive to me that, well, I have a friend who's a painter and maybe he can,
I know the story. I've been there with pop groups who always have girlfriends that can draw.
It's so generic. It's such a generic story. I mean, I know that we've all heard that story before, that you know, the boss's wife and all of that, but you know, I know a guy that, you know, does that kind of, let's let him do the titles. And
at least with Woody Allen, he decides to have the same typeface, and it's, you know, that it's kind of almost like a brand for him, his titles.
I don't even think it's bad. I think it's, I mean, there's a lot of times where it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Titles, and, you know, I don't have any.
Okay, well, look, just to round off, two last questions. What, I mean, there's obviously a lot of young designers that you've inspired, particularly into the area of title design, because it's, you know, it's got far greater notice in recent years, particularly since you've been involved with it. What advice would you give to a young designer trying to get very much into your field and wanting to be very much like you?
I think they should make a title. Yeah. I think that in the general sense, they should work on their storytelling and their ideas and their sort of conceptual design, and then use those skills, you know, basic typography, to maybe redo an existing title sequence or make something speculative thing. Maybe make something in school or make something. You know, there's nothing. It used to be that we could take refuge in the fact that it was too expensive to get a camera.
Sure.
But we couldn't make films because it was too expensive to get the 35mm camera. But there's really no reason that you can't, you know, the technology available, that you can make a low-resolution project yourself. And then I would take that project, make it to the best of your ability, and then distribute that using the internet technology that we now have to anyone that you think is doing work that's inspirational.
Yeah.
Try to get into that business. You know, or you could do the same, show that same thing to a director that's working on a feature. That might be a little bit harder to get to the person than it would be to get to some of the design firms that are doing titles.
Sure.
There's a whole hatful of them now that do it. So I think you just show something, make something. There's nothing stopping you. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might.
Yeah. Okay. One final question. If you were not doing what you were doing now, which I know you love doing, what would you do?
I'd like to be a writer. I think I would write more. I'd try to write books, you know, a novel or something, or a screenplay. So
is that what you do when you're on holiday or when you're away from the studio and not involved with a movie? You're maybe thinking about your own scenarios and your own stories.
Right, it's more academic.
Ah, really?
So the kinds of things that they're not necessarily entertainment-based things, but I have ideas of things I'd like to, you know, explore further. I'm interested in Shakespeare, something that looks at the metaphor and the use of words in Shakespeare and the kind of but I haven't had to put this into words.
No.
First time putting it into words, but you know, there's these the juxtaposition of words to mean a different thing,
which is what you've been doing in titles for a long while.
Yeah,
actually.
and I think it's a recurring thing. The union of words that new ideas that come from juxtaposing words that are not, have not historically, or at least in been juxtaposed. Having more time to really look at language is interesting to me.
Well, I hope that you do get that opportunity, Kyle. Kyle Cooper, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mike. It was good talking to you.